I don't want this interview to be kind of glorying in the past. But if you remember the Apostle Paul, when he said things like, I used to be a persecutor, I used to be a blasphemer, he kind of talked about his history. And yet God being in that history and drawing him to himself, to an incredible life. And really, this is what this interview is about. It's not glorifying the past. It's kind of keeping things in context. So, sorry, I know that I'm just getting a few words in, because I know that in a minute I'm not going to get a word in, because once Anna is away, she's in full flow. So Anna's life story. Can we just put up the first picture, please? Oh, look at that. You had some hair there, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Can you just explain a little bit about that?
Well, I was born in 1966. That's the year that England won the World Cup. Not that I'm into football, but...
Good year.
I was born in Greenwich in London. I was my mum's firstborn, so I'm actually the eldest of seven. And my mum and dad at the time weren't married. So... I don't know if you want to move to the next slide, just so I can show you them. So my mum, when she had me, she was 22, I think. She was born in 1943 during the war. And my dad was born in 1912, actually just a few months before the Titanic sank. So he was quite a lot older than her. He was, I think, 31 years older. And they had met because my father was a choir master and an organist, and my mum was in his choir. So, and to just give a little bit of quick background to how they ended up together, my mum was born in 1943, like I said. She was born to Polish parents, but her Polish dad didn't even know she existed for quite a long time. Her mum and dad had escaped Poland during the war. And actually, I'm meant to be talking to you, so you're interviewing me.
No, okay.
And her mother had concealed her pregnancy and took her to a baby home in Devon. And she said she was going to come back for her, but she didn't. So she effectively abandoned her there. And the lady running the baby home took her on and brought her up. So that lady I knew is my Granny Rose. She was a nurse. She was she'd never married. She was an orphan herself. So my mum never had a father figure, which is why I think she ended up in a relationship with my dad. And I was the result of that relationship. And my dad was already married. He had a child that was my mum's age, or he's just a couple of years younger. He's called Richard. So my dad actually left his first wife to commit to my mum and to me. So that's kind of that bit in a nutshell.
That's good. The age gap, that's incredible. But he was a great guy, wasn't he?
He was a lovely man, yeah. He was a really kind, caring man. He was talented, he was musical, he taught me the piano. He loved photography, so you know, he had a dark room in the back of our house. He used to help with developing photos. He had a great sense of humour, but he did pay the price really for we'll talk about it later.
That'll all come out. Yeah. You didn't tell me you could play on it, did
you? Not very well. I can't anymore.
We've got a future piano player. Wow. To be honest, there's been so much that's come out in these last few weeks. In fact, when Jenny came and Scarlett, we had a meeting in the Fiara. I'm not joking. So much stuff that come out, even just in chit-chat, especially in your naughty days in teaching your sister how to thieve clothing. Yeah, well, not in any way. We're not even going to that. We don't want to... but yeah, really, really fascinating. Let's go on to the next picture. Wow, look at that. Don't that look incredible?
Yeah, so that's my childhood home. So when my sister Jenny came along 16 months later than me, she wasn't a particularly well baby. In fact, she nearly died, I think, several times. But she's here, so that's brilliant. So there she is there. on my mum's lap. But if you go back to the other picture, we moved, or my dad moved us to a little village in Buckinghamshire called Padbury, A, for financial reasons, and B, because it was better for my sister's health, because London wasn't, it was a completely different ball game. So that's where I lived until I was 11 years old. And even though it's a lovely village, my dad was the organist. We went to school there. It was a mile up the village. We used to walk to school. But inside those four walls, it was a completely different story. Right. And my mum was very violent. She obviously had a lot of issues because of her own not knowing where she belonged. She didn't really know who she was. And so that came out in different ways. And so even though she was a very outgoing, talented lady, made a lot of friends with people in the village, she also couldn't control her temper. And so it was there was a lot of random violence towards not only us, but my dad. Yes. And because he was quite a frail, weak man physically, and also he would never have hit her back. He tried to protect us. But we witnessed a lot of violence, and we grew up in a lot of fear. So my predominant emotion growing up was fear. My sister and I actually, we had a code, because my mum could be very unpredictable. She could be really fine one minute and then not the next. So there were very mixed messages coming. So we devised this code. When she called us, then we'd never know what to expect when we got to her. So we devised this code that told us which kind of mood she was in. So this meant she was in a good mood, that's a no. This was in between, and this was an A, this was bad. So we kind of could adjust how we were when we got to her. Right. Yeah, it's kind of sad looking back, but that's what we did. Yeah. It was all survival things. Yeah.
And she also adopted, if we go to the next picture.
She fostered. That's the little boy called Benga. She fostered two black boys at different times. One was called Joseph, one was called Benga. I don't really remember them particularly, but we have a few photos. But we found out later they were removed because she didn't treat them very well. But ironically, we weren't, so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, because looking at your mum, she don't appear to be like that, does she? She looks lovely. She's bonny. But like you said, behind them four walls of what looked a beautiful home,
She had a very complicated personality, and I think, you know, in today's world, she would have got help, people would have recognised it.
Yeah.
Even when people reported abuse, no one did anything, because she was friends with a doctor, she was friends with a health visitor, so, yeah.
Let's move on to the next one.
That's me and my sister Jenny. If you notice, that isn't a collar that she's got around her neck, it's a bandage. And that wasn't my mum's fault at all, it was mine. And the reason was we were brushing our teeth. I was stood on a little stool. She was stood on the toilet with very soapy hands and wanted to come on the stool, and I wouldn't let her. So she slipped and broke her collarbone.
Oh, she broke it.
She still remembers it.
Let's move to the next one. Now, this is a sweet photo. Mm-hmm. But you became more like a mum. And how old were you here?
I was six.
6 years old.
Yeah.
Because obviously you and your sister lived in fear. Whatever mum told you to do, you had to do it. There were no answering back.
No, so I did answer back, but I paid for it every time.
Right. So here is just you being a young mum.
Yeah, well, actually, when he was born, this is my brother Peter, he was born 5 years after me. I was off school ill, and mum had him at home. Yes. Most of us, she didn't, but she did. So I was in the other room when he was born. So the midwife brought him through to see me. I don't know if this is that actual day, but it's not long after. And I remember distinctly thinking, oh, isn't that nice? They come out with blankets on. But I learned to change a nappy age six. And I could make cakes by the time I was eight, and we were just given a huge amount of responsibility from a very early age. So we all had chores. We had animals. Jenny always was meant to look after animals, and as we got older, that became even more of a an expected thing. And I always looked after my brothers and sisters. Right. So right. I've always been like a child magnet since. I just find I just have kids around me all the time. So, yeah.
Yeah, but massive responsibility placed upon you at that age. Mm-hmm. Just to let you know, I think just getting to know Anna and Mike and the family, and looking at the freedom that she has now of just being able to share this. It's just, I think what's really, what's gripped me is the way that God's recovery process in us and what he's done in you is quite remarkable. Let's look at the next one. Here's you.
Yeah, that's me.
On the beach, crying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're really upset there, aren't you?
I was, yeah.
Can you tell us why you're upset?
Well, the story is, my dad, he was a photographer and he did develop his own photos, so he was always taking, which is why we've got quite a few, you know, from that time. I was on the beach, I think the rest of us were on the beach, but he wanted to take a photo of me, so he told me to stand there and he walked away and I thought he was leaving me. So that's why I'm crying, because I thought my dad was just abandoning me on the beach. Yeah. When actually, and then he carried on and still took a picture.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I actually, when I saw that picture, I actually thought she was crying because the tide had come in and wet her feet. Then she told me the real reason. Let's look at the next one. Yeah, here's obviously a picture of you as a family.
Yeah, so this is, we have very few pictures of all of us. So these, this is my mum and my dad, and they had five children together. And that's actually one of the last pictures that was taken of my dad. And we've fast-forwarded quite a lot now, but that's fine, because my mum, she'd made friends with a man in a neighbouring village because he kept goats, and because Jenny had allergies, we needed to get goat's milk. So she made friends with all kinds of people she shouldn't have, but she ended up having a relationship with this, we call him the goat man, so we don't name him. Okay. But that's on a visit, he lived in a watermill in Buckinghamshire, and that's on one visit. She was already seeing him when this picture was taken.
Really? Wow.
But that's all five of us. So after Peter was born, my sister Rebecca was born in 1974, and then my brother Tom was born in 77.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Wow. So at that time, your mum's having a fling.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And we kind of knew, we'd gone into the house and seen him sitting. He was sitting. She was sitting on his lap, and it was quite traumatic. Yeah.
Yes.
Because everything was changing. We didn't really know why.
Yeah. It's a bit of a shock to the system, I think, for a child to see that.
And yeah.
Especially when you've got such a respect and love for dad. Next one, if we can, please. Now, this is
Padbury Church. This is the church that we went to regularly. So Mum was very religious in a way. We always went to church. Even some Christian organisations she was involved with. This was more of a Church of England kind of, formal. But my dad was the organist here, because when he lived in London, he did organ recitals all around the city. So he never lost that. He played in several churches, but this was his main church.
Right.
And Jenny and I were in the choir, so we couldn't really sing, could we? But we had all our robes on, and we always had a bit of a laugh. Like we always, through our childhood, despite everything, we always found, if we weren't being hurt, we would find a reason to laugh.
Yes.
And we used to mix up the end of the hymns, the name, the things that rhymed for fun, and but this particular picture is we'd actually my mum had moved out 3 weeks before, and my sister and I and my brother Peter stayed living with my dad, and my mum had left. We were actually given the choice who we wanted to live with.
Okay.
And I remember desperately trying to persuade Jenny to go with my mum so I could have my dad to myself, but it didn't work.
Right.
We ended up living with him. He was very broken by then because my mum had left, and he took us to church one Sunday evening for the service. We were robing up within the back, heard a crash, thought he'd dropped his hymn books, and then realised the church was deathly quiet. And I pushed through all the people, and my dad he'd collapsed at the organ. and that's the interior of the church. And we always used to help him. I used to sit beside him at the organ, pull out the stops and things, and he'd let us put the hymn numbers up. So that particular evening, Jenny had put up the hymn numbers with him. And that's the last time we saw him. You know, we walked into that church with him and we walked out without him. Yeah. So the parishioners were all saying, you know, you can't go home, because we said we want to go home. And they said, no, your dad will have locked the house. And we said, no, he won't have done. We walked a mile, we ran a mile through the village, and we climbed in a window. Jenny, who gets terrible asthma, ran the whole way and didn't get an asthma attack. And then we ran upstairs, grabbed things out of my dad's drawer. I don't know what, just to be close to him.
Penknife and whatever.
Yeah, I clutched this penknife, remember it. It was a random thing, but it belonged to him. It's like we knew. Yeah. And then I phoned, I think it was the girl who became my stepsister, I phoned her, and then my mum turned up. And it, very coldly, really, she didn't ever really embrace us, but she just put her arms around us and said, Anna, Jenny, dad is dead.
Oh, really?
And that was it. And then we left that house, and we never went back. We went to live in this tiny little silly matchbox house in Milton Keynes. So it was, yeah.
This is where the new dad kind of came in. The creepy one, is that?
Yeah, he was
the one
a creep.
That you didn't like.
We didn't like him.
just tell us, because obviously have you moved? Is it about 37 times that you've moved with? Wow, I know. Just tell us a little bit, because I think now you're in Milton Keynes, you changed schools, you changed surname.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things happened around this time.
Yeah, so there was no time to grieve, so we were just expected to slot into my mum's new life. With nobody talking anything through with us, we had to call this man Dad straight away, which was hugely difficult because, I mean, had he been a nicer guy, you know, it would have maybe been a little easier, but he threw me down the stairs after 3 days, so it just wasn't a good experience. They changed our surnames, so we no longer had our identity. We'd left a school, we'd left our possessions, most of them, we don't know what happened to them. So, you know, and then this man started driving our dad's car, and it all happened so fast.
It's a turmoil, this, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is this where the beating started, Anna?
Well, we were always beaten by my mum, but never my dad. But it was always more random. She'd just be in a bad mood, and
you would get it.
Yeah. But when she moved in with him, he joined in. It became more calculated. They started using different implements.
Dog chains, you mentioned.
Yeah, that came in a little bit later, but it wasn't good. And of course we had siblings that were younger, and we were witnessing them going through that too.
And you're the oldest, aren't you?
I felt a huge sense of responsibility.
On you, again, at such a young age. Yeah. What age were you in Milton Keynes?
Well, my dad died just a week before my 12th birthday.
So 12 years old.
So we went to Milton Keynes for a short period of time, and then we moved to... Where did we move to? We moved to Leighton Buzzard, that's it.
Okay, yes.
And we lived in a terraced house for a while. And that picture there of all of us, that's inside that house. We called it the House of Horrors.
Yes, the House of Horrors, I remember.
I think things just got worse. Where in the village we'd lived in, we had some good friends, good families, and there was a couple that lived across the field from us. They were called Angie and Bill. They were Christians. And we used to go to them. They used to take us on holiday. We found out they prayed for us, you know, and she tried to help us. She took me to the doctor once because I was bruised, you know, and so there was people there that were kind of keeping an eye on us. Whereas when we moved here, there was nobody. Things got much more calculated. That's where they started to use a dog chain. Yeah. I think I was the first person to get that, and I had this great big bruise in my eye where it had gone around my head. And we had nannies, because my mum was a bit of a social climber. She liked to try and keep up with...
The Joneses.
And that nanny left that day. You know, people witnessed things, and then they just left... But we were quite vulnerable at that time.
He looks creepy, don't he, even from a distance?
Yeah, I mean, he is the dad of my half-brother and sister. Okay. And I've had to learn about forgiveness, and I'll talk about that a bit later. Yeah. But he didn't care about us. He didn't expect to get extra children. And he was really scared of my mum, but they used to fight together. So
they
I used to try and split them up.
They used to enjoy fighting.
They did enjoy fighting, but it was a volatile time of life. And we were made home. Well, we were running out of money, so we ended up living on the Grand Union Canal in that narrow boat.
Now, for some people, that would be a dream to live on a narrow boat, but that weren't for you, were
it? No, absolutely not.
You hated this,
didn't you? I hated it. Yeah, Jenny loved it actually, because she loved the outdoors and all that. But I was confined.
Yeah, small space.
Yeah, there was like I don't know, five of us children, and it wasn't good.
Now, is this at this time? Is this where your mum had another fling with a Swedish guy?
No, he was her ex-boyfriend.
Oh, sorry.
So during this time,
right.
My mum got back in touch with an ex-boyfriend of hers who'd gone to Sweden. Jenny and I were invited to go with him on holiday, which we did. He wasn't up to any good.
No, he would have, well, a porn writer, wasn't he?
Yeah, he had us selling really inappropriate material in Sweden. I didn't like him. But we came back from that holiday, which wasn't really a holiday, it really wasn't good. But then he invited me back on my own, and Jenny didn't want to go. And I think for me, it was a lesser of two evils because things were so bad. So I went over there and stayed with him. He was 43, I was 13 or 14. He wanted to marry me when I turned 15, because of Buchanan, you could. And he basically kidnapped me.
Yes.
And I had, my mum was furious. Not with me, actually. I did come back. That wasn't a good time because I was so, so confused. Yeah. I just didn't know where I fitted.
Yeah, because around this time as well, I think you've started going to this Anglican High Church confirmation classes. We're not going to go too much into detail here, but the church army captain who groomed you at that time and took advantage of you as well. So it must have been a massive ball of confusion that you were in. And then from here, you moved to a counsellor state. Is that right? From here. That was quite a rough area too, wasn't it? That was a
rough
place.
Yeah, so my mum got pregnant on that boat. So because she was expecting, we got given this council house in a really rough area.
Right.
We lived for a little while.
Yeah. Now, is this where you've got a book? Some of you might remember this book called Small Corners. Or was it a record?
I got a record, Small Corners. But before that, I got, basically, Jenny and I, started going to this Anglican church in Leighton Buzzard. Some of it wasn't good because of the types of clergy were not good, but we were taken to a gospel concert by Cliff Richard gospel concert, and I loved it, but we also nicked things from the shop, and I came away with this autobiography of Cliff Richard, and that's the only thing that got me through living on that boat, because I started to read his story, and then it was real, and he started talking about God and stuff. So
this is where God began to draw you.
He must have been drawing me.
At the same time, these beatings got worse around this time.
Yeah, they just continued. I was actually thrown out of that council house. They swung me.
And threw me down the concrete steps.
I ran to my friend's house, and then I was gutted when they came to get me. And then she brought a priest to talk to me about my behaviour.
And no one challenged your mum, did they? Regarding your bruises, regarding all that. She was quite
not really
crafty and sly, wasn't she? Really?
She was a strong lady. Yeah, and she did lose a lot of friends. I mean, she moved about because she couldn't maintain relationships. Yeah. I mean, I've learned a lot more over the years about attachment stuff. I realised she had a lot of problems just because of how she started out in life.
Yes.
But she was very difficult to get close to, and she ducked and dived and managed to get away with things. Mm.
So from here, you move then to a watermill. Is that right?
Yeah, so we went back.
Yeah.
My stepfather had been married before and lived in a watermill when my mum met him, and he won that house, so we went to live in it.
There.
And then we had accumulated loads and loads of animals.
What did you have? What kind of animals did you have?
We had goats, chickens, sheep, pigs, horses, dogs and cats.
All the lot, wow.
Yeah, I mean, largely my sister looked after them. We were left. Like my mum used to leave us for weekends. My brother Peter had got into Exeter Cathedral School. He was the head chorister. All her, you know, being up with the elite. And but they'd leave us to look after our siblings and all the animals while they went off for the weekend to see him. So we just got on with it, didn't we, Danny?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've got down here Southwick Farm or No Man's Land.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us about that?
Yeah, so basically, we lived in, I can't remember how many years we lived in that mill. So that was my teenage years. And then to be near my brother in Exeter, my mum and stepdad were looking to move to Devon to be nearer him. So they were buying a house in a place called No Man's Land, which is near Tiverton, if you know Devon at all. And it is really a hamlet. There's nothing there. So we packed up and we had a great big livestock lorry. My sister was in that. I was in a car with my siblings. We rock up outside this house and find that the owners are very much in residence. And so there's a lot of comings and goings, people, the adults going in and out and stuff. And it turned out that we hadn't bought the house at all, and my stepfather, who was a compulsive liar, had lied to my mum and said that we'd exchanged contracts when we hadn't. So
you were down there with all these animals
and
really
all our furniture and everything and nowhere to live. So the story goes, I mean, they were called Harry and Ruth Hill King. They were Christians, and they told us afterwards, obviously, that they would have gladly seen the back of my mum and stepdad, but they said, we can't turn those scruffy kids away.
Right.
So they took us into their house, but they had an annex, like a little granny flat at the end of the house, and they agreed that we could come in and live there until the money went through, which should have been like just weeks. It turned out to be 3 months that we lived with them. They let all the goats and animals into their grounds. They ate all their prize trees, and then my stepfather wasn't feeding them, so Harry would find these animals dead all over the place. But the most amazing thing is that they had six children of their own, and they sat around their breakfast table every single morning and they prayed for us. And they said, and their church said that they needed to get us out because he needed to be looking after his own family, what were they doing? And he said, no, if one of those girls becomes a Christian, it'll be worth it, one of those children. And they really sacrificed a lot. We did eventually buy the house, but they lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they did move where they needed to go, and we stayed in touch with them ever since. My sister lived with them. They became like parents to her. They've always they've just been involved in our lives since.
Really sacrificial giving into that.
Totally. I don't know what we'd have done if they'd have turned us away.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is where you kind of fell in love with Jesus as a figure, because you watched the film, the Jesus of Nazareth film, didn't you?
Yeah.
And how long after that were it when you went to this Billy Graham crusade?
Not long, because they were still living in the house when we went to the Billy Graham crusade. Right. So Harry was talking to Jenny about God, because we noticed they were different. They never argued. They didn't have a TV. There was peace in their home, and we just knew something was different about them. So Jenny used to go into Harry's workshop. He was a sign writer, and ask questions. And I used to get her to ask the questions, because I was bold in one way, but not in others. And then they invited us, or they put us in touch with a friend that took us to a Billy Graham rally in Bristol. And previous to that, I'd been watching Jesus of Nazareth. It was Easter time. It was near my birthday. And I was just in awe of who Jesus was, because he was a kind man that had authority. Yes. There was just something that I was drawn to. And I always remember I asked my grandmother, the lady that I took my mum in, I was always quite close to her, and she looked out for me, and I used to stay with her in Tunbridge Wells and stuff, but I said, can I have for my birthday the book of Jesus of Nazareth and a little Jesus on a crucifix? That's what she gave me. My birthday was in April, and it was my 18th birthday, and I got very little for my birthday, but they were really important to me. And then we went to Billy Graham, and it was just like a light was turned on. Yeah. You know, Billy Graham, he is amazing at the way he just talks about the Bible. Yeah. He talked about what Jesus had done on the cross, and I just knew that the right thing to do was put my life in his hands. So Jenny and I went forward, and things changed.
You responded to the message you knew that God was talking to you. It's amazing, isn't it? Looking back through all this confusion, all this darkness, that God's power and love is drawing you. Mm-hmm. It's mind-blowing, even to this point. So you went out, you made that commitment to God, but it was a few days afterwards that the realization of that kind of really hit home.
Yeah. I think both my sister and I actually at different times, but we did the same kind of thing. We were out on our bikes, and then I fully decided I want to give my life to Jesus. Yeah. And I knew it was like, I mean, I had done bad things, but it wasn't that. It was all the hurt and the pain and the resentment. I hated my stepdad. I was angry with my mum for the way she treated my dad. I needed to give it to somebody. Yeah. And I needed to be loved. And I'd never experienced real love. I didn't know how to be loved. Yeah. So it was like suddenly...
So your Christian walk really started.
Yeah. Wow. And I went back to Billy Graham the second night because Cliff Richard was singing, actually.
Cliff Richard, here we go. These are the real reasons why she went.
And then we started going to a church. Yeah. You know, we went to Tiverton Assemblies of God, and then we went to Exeter and found, you know, a family and people that accepted you for who you were. And
The recovery process, when God begins within us, you know, the healing, the cleansing, the forgiveness, and he replaces all that, don't he, with this peace, with this power, and with his presence. But because, Anna, you've gone through such a lot, you've still gone through difficult times, even as a believer. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at the time. We're okay. We're fine. You were 18 years old. I think then things begin to change in you, didn't they? No sleeping around, no sleeping with your boyfriend. You really wanted to honour God, and I think then you went off to be, you trained to be a nurse.
I didn't finish my training. I did a year's psychiatric nursing.
Okay, just right, 1 year.
Yeah.
Just tell us a bit about being a Christian and struggling with evangelism and witnessing. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, after I became a Christian, I was really, really, I really wanted to please God. I wanted to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. I did in a lot of areas. I stopped a lot of things that I knew, black and white. You know, I didn't want to do them anymore. Yeah. I didn't want to swear anymore, you know, for instance. But I think because of the way I was brought up and I hadn't been, I wasn't very good socially. I could look after kids, I felt safe in church. But when it came to being out in the outside world, I felt hugely intimidated. My self-esteem underneath was still pretty low. I was always terrified of making a mistake. And I remember when I was doing nursing, I was fine when I was out on the wards doing things. But when I was with my, you know, sort of peers in a group setting, I was paralyzed with fear. And I constantly thought, but I need to tell them, you know, that Jesus is real. And I couldn't do it. And then I would get under a pile about it.
Yeah,
I just couldn't.
I
battled a lot of emotional stuff. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that continued, through my walk, really, for quite a number of years. Mm-hmm. So I got married. I got married at 20.
Yeah, because you always wanted a godly husband, didn't you?
I knew I wanted my partner to share my faith. Yeah. I didn't want the legacy of divorce that my mum had. I mean, she, by the time she died, she'd had five husbands. So I just wanted a Christian that was good looking, and I thought that would sort everything. I thought I'd have a secure, and my expectations probably were far too high, but at the time, so I met Darren, this guy who came into some meetings that we were at in Exeter, and to cut a long story short, we got married in America. I got pregnant with Dan, very quickly, so we came back here, and we travelled a bit with an evangelist. But all the time, I think I was struggling with what had happened. Yeah. I didn't know it at the time, but I had three children under three.
Yeah.
So by the time my third child was born, we were living in, well, we lived in Devon, and then we moved to Shrewsbury. But my husband had come from he'd been adopted. He had a different upbringing to me. He'd never really had any experience with children. So I fell back into the role of being the one that did everything. Right. He kind of went back into where he'd come from. So he couldn't be the husband that I wanted, and he couldn't be the dad that I wanted him to be. Not his fault. Yeah. We both had baggage, and I would describe it as we couldn't help each other unpack, because we both had full suitcases, kind of thing. So we muddled through. But after my third child was born, that was Gemma, we moved to Shrewsbury, and I thought we'd be part of this really vibrant, healthy church. It didn't really work out that way, and there was a steady decline in my mental health.
And this is where you began to really, you struggled quite a bit, didn't you?
Because I did.
Kind of just working through all that, you were sectioned for 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think obviously the moving around, the pregnancy, the broken dreams, everything mm-hmm. just kind of, the dream of a husband who mm-hmm. didn't turn out as you wanted. And he was quite violent anyway, wasn't he? I think he had his own issues.
Yeah, he never, only once did he ever lay a finger on me, but there was other stuff. He had a big, he went into a drink. Yeah. It was very difficult, and because I was determined my marriage would last forever and I would never get divorced and I would never leave him, despite I would believe God to bring him through. And but there came a point where it wasn't safe for the children. And I'd voiced things through my younger years and no one had really listened to me. You know, that guy that abused me, I took him to court 20 years later. You know, he was found not guilty for lack of evidence. So I lost my fight, I think, and so it was a struggle, to.
But that's in that time, because you needed someone to understand you,
mm-hmm.
And in that time, you just chatted with God.
I did, yeah.
And God chatted with you, and so that mm-hmm. again, that relationship really it got strong, didn't it? And he'd speak to you about all kinds of things, and I think you met a lady called Sue. Gave you a bit of a picture of.
Yeah.
Can you just explain?
Yeah, so I eventually started going to a church in Shrewsbury that it was the church actually that I was at before I moved to Shetland. I finally didn't feel like I was being judged, A, for having depression, B, for having a marriage that was failing. And I found a safe place. And I remember I sat in the front, one row back from the front, cried my eyes out through the whole service. And someone sat in the front row turned to me and turned around and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." And my friend Helen that was with me at the time, she said, "No, she's not." And that man was Robert Weston, for anybody that knows Robert. He prayed with me. I met some other, and he put me in touch with this lady called Sue,
yes.
who I used to go to for counselling. And she was she's one of my best friends now, but I took my kids. They were just little. They sat colouring on the floor. And through a process, I mean, she didn't let me off with anything. You know, I did have to still walk in forgiveness. And with my mum, it was a continual process. Yes, things would come up. But also, she was unconditionally loving. But she gave me this picture because my life was quite chaotic and I struggled so much because I knew I was a Christian. I knew how I should be.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, some people, you know, I was judged for not being where I should be or where they thought I should be. So I had all kinds of things going on in my life. And she gave me this picture and she said, "Anna, it's like you're in a house, you're the house, and you've got this fence around you that's completely broken down. People are trampling in and out of your house, in and out of your garden, all over your flowers and everything." She said, "You need help. You need to rebuild your fence, put the boundaries up, and then you choose who comes in and out." You know, and it really, really helped me. I've held on to that to this day.
Yeah.
And the other thing I've held on to is scripture.
Yeah.
Because when I was in hospital, it was the darkest time of my life. I didn't smile. I was about 6 stone. But I still knew I couldn't go back to not having God in my life. So I would write out scriptures that he'd given me, like, when I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light unto me. Or, you know, that he would bring me through. And I, even in the dark, I just thought, no one else gets me. I'll have to talk to God about it. And so that, I was quite raw.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how I came out. And then I met Sue. Beautiful. And then gradually I started to feel like something was happening, and
yes,
all those layers that I'd, those barriers, or it's like, I suppose I heard someone say once, when so much happens to you, when you have so much trauma, it's like you put everything in the deep freeze and you just leave it there because you've got a function.
Yes.
So your life becomes quite in compartments and boxes, yeah, and then you start to feel a bit better. It all starts thawing out, and it comes out sometimes not in a good way, but you need to deal with it.
Yeah, because you mentioned a lovely quote that you got from Mercy Ministries about the lamb being on the shoulders of the shepherd.
Yeah.
The lamb can hear all yeah, all the speech and the voice of the shepherd so close and intimate.
Yeah, when he's
and
carrying
I think that
you,
is what he did yeah, with you during that dark time.
Yeah.
And I think getting to know Anna and listening to a story, and I look at it and think, she's nowhere near. She's nowhere near how she described herself. So I know that God's done just some incredible stuff in your life. You said during that time as well that God became your husband.
Mm. Yeah, when I was in my marriage that wasn't going well, you know, when I came out of mental hospital, which was like a horrible old institution, so I shouldn't have come out when I did, but I had to come out because I was not staying there. I got home and my husband had started a relationship with someone else, and there were bottles of drink in the garage and that, and he told me he was washing his hands of me, but I knew I couldn't go back, so I had to trust God. And someone gave me a book by a lady called Stormy O'Marsh, and she, it was The Power of the Praying Wife. And it had a woman with long blonde hair on the front, and I thought, oh no, you know, have I got to pray for him yes, even more, kind of thing. And I did. I went through chapter by chapter, and it didn't change him actually, but it did change me.
Yeah.
And then I realised God was my husband. I got that. There's a verse somewhere in the Bible about the Lord is your husband, and so that's how I let him be the lover of my soul. I let him be the one I talked to and that was intimate with me, and yeah, it was absolutely wonderful. It was, there was such a freedom in it.
And God's yeah, really, he's built you from that point, really,
yeah,
hasn't he? You got to a point then about your children are growing up. They begin to leave the nest.
Yeah, so we moved here
yeah,
in 2002.
Yeah.
I'd left my husband 2 years before, and I'd moved two doors down from my friend Sue, and then God called me here. In fact, he called me here before that, but I'd shelved it all. Didn't quite have the faith to step out. I struggled a lot with stepping out, but I'd written it all down. And then Robert Weston, the man I was that I mentioned earlier, he was in Shropshire. They phoned me and said, "What do you think about us moving to Shetland?" Because she'd seen a job here, and would you come with us? And I said, "Well, you don't know this, but I already feel I should be there." So I came up here, and as a single mum, and it was also very freeing because
yes,
there was a lot of stuff going on, and my kids needed the freedom to grow up without that, all that,
yeah,
you know, the dad not knowing what was going to go on. So there, we had a year in Bigton, and then where Jenny lived at the time, but she moved away, and then I lived 9 years in Cunningsborough, and you know, my kids sort of grew up here. My girls all married Shetland mm-hmm, men. And my son at 17, he went back and went down to Wales, and he gave his heart to the Lord not that long after that.
But you knew that.
And I always knew that he would come
that
through.
Would come to know the Lord.
I did, yeah, because he struggled more with,
yeah,
because he didn't have a dad that was a good role model,
yeah,
and he kind of went a bit wayward for a while, but I always knew. I knew his name when he was in my womb, you know, I just knew that
yeah,
God would bring him through. So he's now married to a pastor's daughter down in
yeah,
Wales.
Fantastic.
But as my children started to leave home, I didn't know who I was anymore. I started to get wobble again inside. And it was like that empty nest kind of syndrome.
An escape.
And
just wanted to escape from
I
that.
I started to struggle with living here quite massively. But I didn't have the courage to actually leave. So I would drive around with a packed suitcase in my boot.
Just in case you got the courage to
leave. Just in case I had
the
courage to get on the boat and go, yeah. Because I knew I still hadn't dealt with a lot of past stuff and it wasn't happening here. I just was frustrated because I knew I wasn't who I was meant to be, but I couldn't get there. Yeah. I did try and move away, but by this time I'd been seeing Mike. And poor Mike didn't really know what I was doing and what I wanted to do. And he was so, so patient with me. But I was frightened, I think, of hurting him because I didn't feel sorted. Yeah. I thought I might ruin his life. So I couldn't decide if I wanted to be in Shetland or not. So when my son got married, I moved away for 2 months. I gave up my house in Cunningsborough. I put all my stuff, the rest of my stuff, in Mike's house. Poor Mike. So I leave, but I leave him with all my things. And he doesn't know if I'm ever coming back. I don't want to come back, but I don't really know what to do. Yeah. So, but I did come back because I was meant to. And when I first moved to Shetland, God gave me a scripture, even if I settle on the farthest side of the sea, even there your hand will lead and guide me.
Yes,
and I realized when I came back, he did want That's me it. To settle here.
Because God spoke to you in Wales, didn't you? You were there for, what, 2 months?
2 months, yeah.
Yeah, and then so, back, and then...
And then I came back, and then Mike and I got married. Yeah, you
the
know,
man of your dreams, the man that you've always been looking for.
And he probably thought it was never going to happen, but I mean, it was just one thing after another. And it was, in some ways, not completely, because I do love Mike, but it was a step of faith. I knew, because I'd never, ever had somebody... I'd never been loved unconditionally, and I'd always, all my life, had to be the provider. I've had to, you know, choose houses, I'd had to bring in the money, put food on the table, and for the first time in my life, and I only realised this afterwards, because I'd started some counselling with a place in Edinburgh over the phone, that I'd never, you know, looked at other things, because I'd always been trying to deal with these practical things in my life and for everybody else. I'd rescued everybody but couldn't rescue myself. Yeah. So once I married Mike, we settled down, we got a house and everything. I started to really, really be healed. Yeah. I can't explain it, but I am very, very different to how I was. And some people here would remember me when I was actually quite ill.
Well, how you described yourself even this morning, it's like looking at a different person and listening to a different person. But this is God.
It is.
He's just so incredible with his love and grace and kind of breaking into people's lives. I asked Anna a question as we were talking a few days ago. And I'm going to ask you this question. I'm going to just hand over to you, just for you to finish off this morning. Things like, where were God in all this? Where were God in all this turmoil and darkness and rubbish and then drawing you to where you are now. I'm just going to leave that with you, and I'm just going to hand over to you just to finish off this morning.
Okay. the thing is, he was always there, but I didn't always know it. So he was moulding me, he was shaping me. You know, we put ourselves in his hands when we become a Christian, but we don't become instantly perfect. We're not instantly sorted. And so even though, you know, that's my most of my extended family now. I've got two more grandchildren on top of that picture. God's been so good. But he was there, but I didn't always know he was there. And when I was an early Christian but still struggling, I've always held on to a verse in Job, because Job went through some horrendous stuff and his friends were saying, you know, give up, and he didn't. But there's a scripture, but he knows the way that I take, and when he's tried me, I'll come forth as gold. And the verse before that says, behold, I look forwards, I can't find him, he's not behind me. And there was a time when I could not find God, but yet I always knew he would bring me out. So one thing that really helped me was scripture. It was life to me. And it says heaven in the Bible, heaven and earth will pass away, my words will never pass away. In the beginning was the word, the word was God, was with God, the word was God. And I think I knew deep down that I had to hold on to him, even though I couldn't always see him. And it's funny, actually, Phil didn't know this is my verse that I was going to read, but Psalm 139, we're knit together in our mother's womb, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. and he made us. You know, we've all got that in common. We all started in our mother's womb. I know the world's trying to change that, but really 100% of us here, I'm sure, have had that same start in life. And he created us. He knows us better than we know ourselves. So it makes sense to put ourselves in his hands, because we just can't fix ourselves. And we can think we can, but it's like if my car's broken, I send it to the garage because I put it in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing. You know, I wouldn't attempt to try and fix a car. Some people try and attempt, you know, Mike likes a bit of DIY. He's pretty good at trying to fix things before we go and pay for it. But if you break your leg, you go to hospital. But when we're broken, so often we don't go to the source of the one that can fix us. And even if we say we trust him, sometimes we just struggle to let go of things. You know, we've all got things in our past. We might feel we failed as a mom or a spouse, or we might feel we should have taken that job and we didn't take it. But the thing about God is he's the potter, we're the clay. And a potter's really skilled at what he does. And I watched a YouTube clip. It's called Four Steps of a Potter or something. It's quite short. It's really interesting, the process, because the potter has to balance the clay on the wheel. So he wants to get hold of us before he can shape us. The wheel moves, so that's like our life and circumstance. And there's a lot of water involved. There's a lot of washing and, you know, cleansing. And then once it's balanced on the wheel, then he starts to shape the clay into something, into a vessel. But he doesn't scoop out the clay and toss some away. He uses everything. So every single thing you go through, he still can use it. And then, so nothing's wasted. And then, you know, when it's kind of ready to be made into something beautiful, he lifts it up and it's still quite fragile. And it says in the Bible, there's a verse that says, a bruised reed he won't break and a smoking flax he won't put out. And it really, that just means when you're down and broken, he's not going to snap you in half or make it worse. He's tender. His hands are sensitive. It says that our names are engraved on the palms of his hands. You know, we're that close to him. He loves us. He knows us all by name. And then he shapes this pot into something beautiful. And in Jeremiah 18, there's a story where Jeremiah is told to go down to the potter's house, and he sort of watches this potter. And then the pot is marred. It says, you know, the pot's marred in the potter's hand, so he just makes another pot. And that's so God. Sometimes our lives end up in a mess. And when I was going through my Christian life, I've made a lot of mistakes, a lot of bad choices amongst that. But God still gives you second chances. And he takes that pot and he just starts again and uses that same clay. So if you ever feel like, oh, it's too late for me, or, you know, I missed it here, it doesn't matter. Put yourself back in his hands, because he can use you. And often that happens in the dark. So sometimes you don't know what's going on in your life. The potter works in isolation. It's often away from other people. You know, when my dad developed those photographs, it was in a dark room, and you gradually watch the picture emerge. But it's still and a tree in the winter. It looks like nothing's going on. It looks dead. It isn't dead. It's something going on within it. And sometimes I think we look at our own lives and we think, oh, nothing's happening. You know, that person over there is really going on, doing great. They've got potential. I've got nothing. I've gone through all this. But it doesn't matter. God is doing something in you. I've put here, it's better to trust him in the dark than walk in the light without him. And it's so true. And I just wrote a few things about his hands. And really, in his hands, we're safe. We're secure. There's stability, and we might not feel like it, but we can trust him. He'll calm our storms, not necessarily storms of circumstances, but our inner storms, our turmoil that nobody sees. And if you put yourself in his hands are strong and they're sensitive. And you'll never know your true potential till you put yourself in his hands. And if you don't have the strength, I just ask him, like a father, he'll pick you up. You know, you're his child. And it doesn't mean you throw away your own desires or your own talents, because he's given them to us. So he wants to walk with you. So that voice that says, no, you can't ever be used by God, or you'll never be good at X, Y, Z, our path doesn't define us, Jesus does. And there's a poem written by a lady in 1921 that was turned into a song, but it's called The Touch of the Master's Hand, and it's the story of a violin, an old violin. It's been used, it's broken, it's battered, and it's being auctioned. And it's just going for nothing, like £1, £2. And then someone stands up from within the auctioneer's room, and he walks to the front, and he picks up the violin, and starts to play it. And he plays this beautiful music. And he's the musician, he's the master that created the violin. And when you're in his hands, he can do something with you. But left on the side, it was just a piece of wood. And so if we put ourselves in his hands, he will bring out our true value and what we're made for. And there's in Japan, the way they fix pots is they bring all the pieces together with gold. And I love this because it's so like God that he takes all our shattered, broken pieces. And I was probably about 20 different people. Like, I needed to be brought together. But they turn it into something beautiful, and they believe that the scars actually bring beauty out into that pot, and I love that. And when I was never able to be a child, so I found when I became a Christian, I loved the fact that I could hold my father's hand. I loved the verse about him being an everlasting father and it always being there for me. And there were two songs I used to listen over and over again. One was Don Francisco on Never Let Go of Your Hand. And it talks about, it doesn't matter where you've been, what you've done, whose bed you've slept in, he's going to hold your hand. And there's another song by a group called The Cry, Take My Hand and Walk Where I Lead. You Will Never Be Alone. And I knew that. And, you know, he never will leave you or forsake you. You can't get away from his love. And I'd just like to encourage you to put yourself in his hands this morning. If you don't know Jesus, the best decision you can make is to put yourself in his hands. And he'll give you a fresh start and a new life. And if you do know him, just surrender anything you're struggling with, any fears, anything. He'll be there for you. We're going to play a song. This song my daughter Chloe gave me or sent me. I was living in Cunningsborough at the time. I was really struggling with where I was meant to be in life and who I was. And my kids have just been amazing. God's been so good because they're all Christians, and they've been so good with me, because there have been times I've probably really not been a good mum. But they've just loved me anyway. And she sent me this song. And I would just encourage you just to let God speak to you while it's playing. You know, if you feel you want to come kneel down, if you want to just sit where you are. But it's just letting us know that God knows. He knows exactly where we're at. And he can do anything. He can do amazing things. And I look at my own story and sometimes I just cry because I think, goodness, like, how did that happen? But it has been him. And I know there's more and more to come. So, you can trust him with your future, because he's, even though your future might be unknown, he's a known God. Yeah.